Thank you very much, and good morning. I wondered if I could ask Tammy to help distribute two handouts that I'll be referring to. Thank you very much. I have a number of items that I want to report on, and Deputy Director Storr also has a few items as well. The items that are being handed out to you right now, I'll get to here in a few minutes. And the items are quite different in topic area, so I'll be jumping around a bit. And I'm going to finish up with a trip up to the front table there to show you a couple slides, provided that they're on the computer, which I know they are because Tammy put them on there. I don't need them right now. I'm going to start out with the hoof rot disease update. Of course, the commission's heard a lot about this issue in from the public and as well as department staff, and wanted to just take a few minutes and give you kind of a status report on that topic. We've had staff continue to work with researchers to try to identify the cause of the disease that's been observed in two herds, both at Mount St. Helens herd and the Willapa Hills herd, and obviously in Southwest Washington. Two collection efforts of Young of the Year elk have occurred in 2013. Diagnostics are still ongoing from those animals. Our primary challenge has been the detection of early lesions in effective elk. We've sampled animals too far into the April time frame and too early for lesions to be developed, which in the August time frame, thus the likely additional collections in the next month or so to try to get the timing of those collections appropriate for analysis. A good news piece is that there, so far we've found no evidence of significant inflammation or infection above the hooves, even in severely affected animals. That is to say that the muscle meat above the infected areas appears to be in good condition. We're also submitting a funding request to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and in the governor's supplemental FY14 budget for $200,000 of wildlife state to help with our investigations. As you know, we've established a working group to help us sort through this issue, share information about the disease itself, discuss research and management questions, as well as public outreach and helping inform department's adaptive management approach to addressing the issue. That meeting, or that group, has met twice this fall. They reviewed what is known about hoof disease managed in livestock. They've reviewed overall challenges associated with disease management in wildlife. The group has now progressed to exploring a possible suite of management options, including reducing elk density, establishing containment areas, treatment as a way to verify possible cause, and or letting the disease run its course. There are numerous parameters being applied to each option, including effectiveness, feasibility, cost, sustainability, priority, and anticipated public support. The current key management question has been, what is the primary cause of the disease? Other research questions which will help inform our management response will include, what is the prevalence of hoof disease in elk? What is the effect of hoof disease on the population itself? And is there a generic link, resistance, propensity in the disease? The departments will be digesting that feedback received from our technical collaborations and from the public working group, and continue to incorporate information from the diagnostic investigations and begin to develop a draft strategy to implement. Probably goes without saying, but everyone's pretty frustrated with not having concrete answers and the continuing observation of the animals that have that disease. I think one takeaway message on this one is that this is going to be around for a long time. There's no quick fix, so it's a problem that's going to be confronting us over a long period of time. So we're going to go from some fur to some shell here now, going to the coastal crab fishery. Those of you who are familiar with that fishery know that it's one of our most valuable commercial fisheries in Washington. And as part of managing that fishery, we do condition tests that we begin in around the third week of October. We collaborate with the states of Oregon and Washington. We have an agreement to cooperate that's been signed by the directors of California, Oregon, and Washington. And we also have a tri-state Dungeness Crab Committee that includes about six industry representatives from each state that meet at least annually, if not more often, to discuss management issues. And as part of that process, we've developed a crab testing protocol document. As part of that document, there's meat pickout minimum criteria that needs to be met before you open the fishery. And we have a difference in that meat pickout rate minimum. It's 25% meat pickout rate below Cascade Head, and it's 23% for the areas from there north to the U.S.-Canada border. I won't try to go into the reasons for the differences right at the moment. We did make some pretty significant changes in our testing protocols this last year where we're not rounding. So if you're 22.8, you don't round up to 23. You wait until you get a test that says there's 23% pickout rate in the area north of Cascade Head. And the other thing is you don't project. So before, if you had a 20% meat pickout rate on October 23rd and you had 22% on November 15th, you could look at the meat increase and you could project as when it would meet the 23% and make your decision about when to open the season based on that projection. No longer doing that, waiting until we actually get in a sample crab that meet that 23% minimum pickout rate. So whenever you change protocols and you're coordinating with other states and there's multiple management areas along the coast, you can run into some growing pains when you're adopting a new approach like that, and we did to some degree this year, but overall I think it has gone pretty smoothly. We did delay the opener off Southern Washington and Oregon down to the Oregon-California border based on the test results. We would, the earliest we would open the season in those areas is December 1. But because the meat pickout rates didn't meet those minimum thresholds in all the areas, there was a delay. We held some additional testing both in Oregon and Washington here this past week, and got good news. Our Long Beach pickout rates were all the way up to 26.5%, Astoria 26.2%, and the other area that was critical was off of Newport, and it was 27.9%. So crab condition improved pretty dramatically, relatively quickly, and so we're set to open our fishery on December 16th. So our fishers will be, and this is below Clipson. So Clipson, for those of you who don't know where Clipson Beach is, it's about halfway up the Long Beach Peninsula. So from there south, we'll be allowing the fishers to set their gear beginning the morning of December 13th. And then starting December 16th, they can begin to pull that gear and retain crab and deliver it into port. The tribal fishery has already opened. Macaws, Quileutes, and Quinault. Quinault opened on November 25th, I believe it is. We have agreements in place with Macaw and with Quileute. We don't have an agreement in place yet with Quinault, but we're working on one. We have typically had as part of those agreements, a 46 to 49 day head start for the Quinault fishers before our fishers start, and we've been achieving about a 53-47% sharing of the crab within the Quinault's usual custom fishing area, which is from Destruction Island south down to Point Chehalis off the north end or the south end of Grace Harbor, and then including Grace Harbor. So we're going to go from shells to dollar bills, and so that's this landscape legal size document. And I won't spend a lot of time on this. You'll recall that in November provided you some information, and I was ringing some pretty loud alarm bells about the decline in, or anticipated decline in, federal funding in a number of different areas. There are four areas represented on this piece of paper. We've done some further refinement of the numbers that I provided you in November. So looking, you can see how it's organized down the left-hand side of the column with Mitchell Act. PACSURF is the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Fund. That's what that acronym stands for. PST is Pacific Salmon Treaty or Pacific Salmon Commission. And DJ is Dingell Johnson. That's what that stands for. There's two pieces of pertinent information on here. One is what the current CR or continuing resolution is, extended through 2014. That's also subject to sequestration reductions. And so you can look and see there's both annual change as well as a biennial impact column there to look at, so you can have an understanding of what those cuts are anticipated to be. And then in addition, we have the President's Federal Fiscal Year 14 budget. The Senate generally has numbers that are a little bit higher than what is represented in the President's budget, and the House generally has numbers that are lower for those categories than what's in the President's budget. Again, we had Jennifer Kwan, who's our federal liaison, deliver these, our message back to our congressional offices several weeks ago in Washington, D.C., so that our congressional members are aware of these cuts and what they mean. You'll recall in November I gave you some estimates about what types of reductions in hatchery production and other consequences from these cuts would be, so trying to give them a sense of what's on the horizon. We've also had considerable interest from the governor's office and OFM on these cuts, and so we have briefed them and will continue to have further discussions with them so they have a complete understanding of what's at stake with these cuts. We've also talked with the tribes. I don't want to say we've talked to all the tribes, but we've been beginning to have discussions with some of the tribal leadership on these cuts. And as you will hear in a moment, I've been talking about having a joint trip back to D.C. at the appropriate point in time, which would probably be along deadlines of the end of February, where the members would hear both from the tribes as well as the state. And we're also going to be, once we get a little better definition to the problem, we're going to be calling together a group of our stakeholders and sharing this information with them. We've already shared it with some, and look at building some coalitions to try to that cross the private sector, the government, and tribes, so that we can try to build a coalition to try to at least reduce. I don't know that eliminating these cuts is a realistic possibility, but if we can reduce the magnitude of them, that would be obviously very good for the department. There's that right at the bottom there on the left, you'll see that bottom table that summarizes the information that's in more detail above in those four different areas. So I'm going to switch gears now and talk a little bit about some of the legislative activities. November, there's a legislative committee week. It was the week of during the week of November 20th. Pretty impressive effort by Ann Larson, our legislative liaison. In 3 days, she met with over 30 members individually. We also took that opportunity to have Chief Steve Crown visit those and be introduced to legislators. I accompanied her on some of those, certainly not all 30 of them. There were also some work sessions in November on the 14th. Expenditures and efforts for wolf and livestock interactions was one of those work sessions that went well. Aquatic invasive species was another one, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. The Regional Fishery Enhancement Group long-term funding update was another one, and we also had questions about the ownership of our downtown Olympia buildings. You may recall we were directed to sell our three properties downtown. Two of those properties have vacant buildings on them. We have completed the sale of those two properties. However, we still have the one property where the Department of Wildlife used to be housed down on 600 Capitol Way. And we have our capital assets and management program housed down there now. We relinquished a lease on a building we had down on Plum Street. And we moved that staff in our fiscal office and payroll up to the first floor here in the Natural Resource Building. And we've retained that building on 600 Capitol Way because it's a much cheaper way for us to house those staff members than it is to go and continue a lease like down at Plum Street. So we had an opportunity to explain that to some legislators had interest in what we were doing there. We have the agency requests legislation on aquatic invasive species. We had an opportunity to walk through on a section by section basis that piece of legislation with the Senate Natural Resources and Parks Committee. There's still a lot of interest in that from certain legislators, both on the Senate and the House side. And we've been working with the governor's office in making some changes to the package to a point that they would find acceptable. And so work is ongoing there. On that aquatic invasive species piece of legislation, it's been pretty remarkable at the amount of support that we've received and letters and testimony. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council provided strong support. the Washington Invasive Species Council, Trout Unlimited, Northwest Marine Trade Association, and the Washington Recreation and Conservation Office, RCO, that's Kayleen Cunningham is the director of that, provided strong support for us. The other area that we spent quite a little bit of time talking about is our hunter education bill. You'll recall that we tried to get this through the legislature last year, got pretty darn close. So we're continuing to work with members to address specific issues that they have about. There's kind of three key pieces in there. There's a minimum age of 8 to participate in a hunter education class. There's a requirement to be accompanied by a licensed adult if you're under the age of 14 and you're not hunting on private property. And then there's a fee, a $20 registration fee. Those are kind of the three key pieces. So there's, you know, we knew there would be debate around the 8-year-old. Is that the right age? Should there be a minimum age? So that meant fair policy call and question to the legislators to debate. And then the other one is talking about the accompaniment. Should the individual have to be a licensed hunter? Should or not? You'll recall that if you were born prior to 1972, you don't have to have a hunter education license or card certification. So does it make sense to require a person that was born before 1972 to have done that before they can accompany a minor, you know, that kind of thing? So those kinds of conversations are going on, but they're all, I think, pretty workable to work through, and so we're continuing to do that. So changing gears again to our how we work with our federal partners at NOAA Fisheries. You'll recall that, some of you will recall at least, that the organizational structure of NOAA Fisheries, or National Marine Fisheries Service, whichever they care to be called, had a Northwest region, which included Washington, Oregon, and a Southwest region, which included California, and at one time it also included Hawaii and the Pacific Islands, but that was broken away and created their own region for Hawaii and the Pacific Islands. So they chose to merge Northwest and Southwest, those two regions, and merging an organization like that is never easy, as we well know here. And I had an opportunity, I was invited to come over and speak with their senior staff in the Sustainable Fisheries Division here this week. Actually, it was yesterday. So where they had folks up from Long Beach that are now under a single region and under in the Sustainable Fisheries Division, which is headed by Bob Turner. And so I know most of those folks, and they were interested if I had any advice for them on how to make a merger successful or less painful, and also discussed, you know, what the expectation was from the state, from NOAA Fisheries, and we also had a good chance to talk about our partnership in a number of different venues, and so it was appreciated being invited over to do that. Next topic is the Washington Marine Resources Advisory Council. This group was enacted through Engross Senate Bill 5603 in Section 4 that created this council within the Office of the Governor. The Marine Resources Advisory Council's membership includes legislative members from the executive branch, elected officials, non-governmental organizations, and private sectors, representatives from academic institutions, federal agencies have been invited by the governor to participate. What the council's powers and duties are includes to maintain a sustainable, coordinated focus on ocean acidification and responses to ocean acidification, to advise and work with the Washington Ocean Acidification Center on effects and sources of that acidification, to deliver recommendations to the governor and legislature on how to counteract ocean acidification, to seek public and private funding resources to support the Advisory Council's recommendations, and to assist in conducting public education activities regarding ocean acidification. There's a pretty long list of folks that are on that council, and I am one of those folks. And we had our first meeting here. It's the chair is Martha Konsgaard, who's with the she's the chair of the Leadership Council of Puget Sound Partnership. Many of you probably know her name. Great. I think she's going to be a great leader of that group. Pretty exciting, daunting task. Ocean acidification is a daunting issue for to think about how you're going to get your hands around and look for solutions. We are seeing the impacts of it first in our shellfish resources, both in Willapa Bay in particular and in Puget Sound, because of the impact on the ability for crustaceans, for that calcification development. So there's a lot at stake from a shellfish perspective, but it also dives down into the very bottom of the food web with copepods and other types of critters that are really important to your forage fish, be it smelt or anchovies or sardines. So it's a really big issue, and it's a really difficult one to solve. But wanted to make you aware of our participation on that. Switching gears again to tourism outreach. Many of you have had the opportunity to meet Jason Wettstein who works with Bruce Botka in our public affairs and community outreach shop. He's just recently spent 3 days on the road the week before Thanksgiving, meeting with tourism and outdoor business owners between Olympia and Spokane. He connected with leaders of the visitor bureaus, chambers of commerce, bait and tackle manufacturers, and outdoor interest groups in Auburn, Issaquah, Ellensburg, Ephrata, and Spokane. He laid the groundwork for some new and expanded collaboration on tourism promotions and youth involvement in outdoor recreation with groups like the Spokane Visitors Convention Bureau, Inland Northwest Wildlife Council, Girl Scouts of Eastern Washington, Potsky Bait Company, Danielson Company, and the Worley Buggerfly Company. That's what it says. So he had, it's really pretty exciting to have Jason have that additional capacity within the public affairs and community outreach group to do these kinds of things. So we're really excited about that work. Moving now to our co-management meeting that we had up in that Marysville at Tulalip Casino back in October 6th or thereabouts. We had our first follow-up meeting here on the 26th of November, and we identified 11 different issues that came out of that meeting, and we began the process of prioritizing those in terms of which ones we were going to work on over the course of the next year. Those 11, I'll just click them off. Habitat, where can we do a better job of working together on habitat issues? North of Falcon, the process improvements, not only process, but just in the kinds of things like making sure you've got the people at the table that can make the decisions and when you're working through that. Our annual co-management meeting, you may recall that in the 1997 co-management stipulation, there's a requirement that the tribes and the department meet once a year, And the month that's referred to in that stipulation is the month of May. And we used to do pretty good at meeting in the month of May. We haven't done so well lately. So wanted to make sure we get back on track in doing that. And part of that is associated, is including the creation of, or the reinvigoration of this, what we called our oversight committee, which looks at the work plan and tracks the work plan that comes out of the North Falcon process. Enforcement is a general category. Update our court-ordered management plans, like the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan, the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan, getting that. We've got two tasks there, really, a temporary fix to get us coverage to get through 2014, and then a longer-term fix to get a new plan developed and approved that would extend over a longer period of time, hopefully at least 5 years. Catch accounting, we had a good discussion about catch accounting and where the issues were on both sides about that. Shellfish management, you remember we talked about shellfish management, and one of the, among the issues were the timing of the commission adopting our regulations, regulating our shellfish fisheries versus when those management plans are completed, and so that's a topic. Budget limitations, and this was primarily revolved around the where can we do a better job of working together, like on the budget issues that we just talked about, and really build, trying to look for ways to build coalitions and partner, recognizing, or at least from our perspective, our belief is that we can be more effective if have the same message and they're hearing that message from us at the same time. So talking about that. Hatcheries, and the conversation around this is the importance of hatcheries for a variety of reasons, from making the treaty right meaningful to continuing to provide robust opportunities for state fisheries that are fueled by hatchery production, recognizing that we've had a lot of reductions. Some of those reductions have been in response, appropriately so, to the Hatchery Scientific Review Committees. But at the same time, we've had some reductions that are purely as a result of budgetary issues. So, and then the last one was building coalitions in support of fish and fishing. And that's all about, and you may recall for those of you that were there, that talked about some of the really great coalitions that were built in the early days of co-management. One of those which was highlighted was the Pacific Salmon Treaty Coalition, which was a grassroots coalition that came from and where the state, the tribes, the public, everybody got together behind a single initiative to try to get that treaty adopted, negotiated and adopted, which would result in the reduction of interceptions of Washington origin fish off Canada and Alaska. So where are there some, rather than where we're kind of, it seems like we're moving more into this adversarial roles in these individual camps, you know, with be it recreational or commercial or the state and the tribes, is there a way to look at some broader benefits and programs that we would all benefit by building those kinds of coalitions? So that was the conversation around that. So those are the 11 topics that we identified. We're writing up a description. We've made a couple of tries at this, but we're working on trying to write up a description of each one of those issues and a response. Some of them are ones that we want to get done this year. We have to get done this year. Some of them, like update court-ordered management plans, we're saying, yeah, that's a good thing to do, but not in the next 12 months. So that's a small group that put that report together and that synopsis of our meeting together and that list of priority issues. And so we're there vetting it through a larger audience in tribal country, and we're doing the same thing on our side. So I'm going to switch gears now and go to an issue that has come up about tribal hunting agreements. You may have seen some correspondence that's come into the commission office here recently expressing concerns about the Department of Fish and Wildlife and our agreements with tribes regarding hunting, geographic scope, open and unclaimed lands, private industrial timberlands, all those types of things. And we have developed a response to those those letters and those emails, that correspondence. And I wanted to just give you a quick walkthrough of what that's all about. So the department has entered into hunting co-management agreements with certain tribes or groups of tribes that were signatory to, you know, one or more of the treaties in Washington. We've been doing that for almost a decade, and it's consistent with the commission's tribal hunting policy. Currently, we have agreements with Skokomish, Jamestown, Sklallam, Port Gamble, Sklallam, Lower Elwha, Sklallam, and with tribes signatory to the Treaty of Point Elliott, including Muckleshoot, Stillaguamish, Swinomish, Tulalip, and Upper Skagit tribes. In these agreements, it acknowledges the overlapping nature of state and tribal jurisdictions and responsibilities, and that that creates a co-management relationship in a sense that the department and their respective tribes have certain authorities that potentially pertain to the same wildlife resource, and that there is a need for the state and tribes to cooperate in the discharge of their respective authorities in order to ensure that healthy populations of wildlife continue to be available to both state and treaty hunters. The agreements provide the department and the tribes for a vehicle to cooperate and coordinate on wildlife management and enforcement. They promote joint efforts to increase access to private industrial timberlands for both state and treaty hunters. Guidance for department's enforcement officers in terms of where does state law apply and when is it preempted by a treaty right, and a process to resolve and hopefully avoid conflicts. Most of these agreements are short length. I mean, they're 1 year or 2 years. Most of them are 1 year. They've been accompanied by, in some cases, presentations from those individual tribes, from anthropologists, where they are asserting a treaty right outside the boundaries of their ceded area, which we reference or refer to as traditional hunting areas. These agreements are developed in accordance with current law, department procedures. They're not determinations of any legal issues, and they provide multiple benefits to both the state and the tribes, and we believe the wildlife resource. So that's not the entire response, but it's some of the important pieces that we provide back to some of the individuals that wrote in with some concerns. I've also had an opportunity to have a telephone conversation with one of the individuals that I think was particularly concerned about the issue. And I think once he understood what it was, because they were representing that we had created a new policy or something that was aligned with the tribe's perspective on the status of privately owned industrial timberlands as being open and unclaimed, so we talked through that, and after having an opportunity to explain it to him, I think his concerns were considerably diminished. So, but The other, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Wolf update. Commissioner Caney did a nice job of talking about some of the successes and some of the really great advances, I think, that we've made collectively with having wolves on our landscape. So our winter surveys will continue through January. We'll have final pack numbers and successful breeding pairs, minimum wolf count, estimated wolf population size be presented to the commission in February. And they'll be and then available in our March 2014 annual report. We've got some activities going on with helicopter captures. They're expected to begin in late January. They're ideal for focusing on packs that already have at least one collared animal to help us know where they are. And our goal is to try to maintain 2 to 3 collars per pack. That's our goal. A lot of work in the conflict management arena over the last few months. As Commissioner Caney reported, no new wolf livestock incidences to report since our last commission meeting. But there's been several different training and workshop opportunities that were either organized by us or we attended. Those include, we had 5 conflict specialists attend a chemical immobilization course offered by Dr. Mark Johnson of Global Wildlife Resources at the end of October. We co-sponsored a 1-day large carnivore trapping training, which was held at Wolf Haven. We hosted a depredation investigation training workshop that was co-instructed by Dr. Mansfield, our veterinarian, and Carter Niemeyer from Washington State University College of Agriculture. And we had 38 participants from private, state, federal, and tribal organizations attend that one. We also conducted training for conflict staff on livestock damage prevention and cooperative agreements. And we've also had the opportunity to continue working with Western Wildlife Outreach to develop a plan for outreach efforts to ensure that we can continue to make progress with informing and educating the public about management of wolves. We also participated in a meeting to discuss potential carcass removal pilot project. It was co-organized with Conservation Northwest, and we had members of the Blackfoot Challenge Project from Montana provide presentations. We had an opportunity to view that personally when we were back in Montana and visited them. So that's got a lot of promise, I think, in terms of making sure that we don't have carcass issues out on the landscape attracting and habituating wolves with particular food type. Our wolf advisory group continues to work really well together, I think. They've got another meeting scheduled for December 19th to discuss codification portions of the wolf conservation management plan. You'll recall we had a petition that wanted to codify a number of those provisions within the plan. In response to that, we said we'd work that issue through the Wolf Advisory Group, and so that's part of what they're doing. Lastly, we on the federal delisting topic area, we've certainly had some interaction between several of our state legislators on that topic, going all the way back into September prior to the time that we provided oral testimony at a hearing at the end of September. We have been criticized for not involving the public or in before taking a position on that issue on federal delisting. Chair Wecker has, I know I've been talking with her a lot about this issue, and she's provided some very valuable assistance in communicating with one of our legislative members who's concerned about the approach. We provided a detailed letter back to them in October that I think you all saw, or if you didn't, we can certainly get it to you, that responded to each one of their concerns about whether or not we were accurately reflecting the wishes and surveying the members of the public that had an interest in this issue. And more recently, we've sent the draft comment letter to our Wolf Advisory Group, asking them if they see any fatal flaws with the way that we're representing the position of the commission on this issue. And one of the handouts that you have is a copy of that draft letter. And if you have any comments on that you'd like to provide to us, please give those to Tammy and I'll get those from her. One of the, you've received a couple of letters recently. Before I go there, in response to sending that letter out, and we may get some comments yet that I'm not aware of, but as of 2 days ago, the Farm Bureau and Hunter's Heritage were both supportive of the letters written. Conservation Northwest indicated they were supportive of eventual federal delisting, but with no confirmed PACs in the South Cascade recovery area, they thought it was too early to delist now. And they were also advocating the potential of having a Pacific Northwest distinct population segment rule as a pathway forward rather than a blanket delisting. So that's what we've heard so far. There's also a letter from the Center of Biological Diversity, I think, that we just got. And in there, they were particularly critical of us in terms of not representing the general interests of the citizens of the state of Washington. And on that topic, I thought one of the things I would refer to is in our October 15th letter to Senator Ranker, Rofus, Representative Litton, and Dunshee, we talked about the surveys of Washington residents on this topic. And I don't think there's any question in anyone's mind. There's a large majority of the citizens of the state of Washington that support wolf recovery, and there's no argument there whatsoever, as we are, as a commission and a department. And if you just ask that question, absolutely. Thanks. I would just call your attention to that in 2008, we had a poll of 805 Washington residents that was done by Responsive Management. And then there was a 2009 mail-in survey, which yielded over 4,000 responses by Colorado State University. And the 2008 phone call poll showed that the majority of Washington residents, 75%, support allowing wolves to recover. That same poll indicated that 61% of the Washington residents supported some level of lethal wolf control to protect at-risk livestock. And in the Colorado State survey, 74.5% of the Washington residents found that natural recolonization of wolves in Washington to be acceptable. So very close to the other one. And that same survey showed that 65.9% of the residents were accepting of lethal removal of wolves that have caused loss of livestock. And 69.8% of Washington residents were supportive of limiting the number of wolves in certain areas if they were contributing to localized declines in deer or elk. So what I am concerned about is that this is not an issue about wolf recovery or our commitment to wolf recovery. The question is whether we're going to be allowed as a state to implement our conservation and management plan, and And with the federal delisting as it now stands in the east western two-thirds of our state, we are not able to do that. And so our commitment to wolf recovery is strong, and we believe that our plan gives us the tools to be successful, and we believe that without those tools, we may not be successful. And so the debate should not be, and is not, from my perspective, about whether or not we're fully committed to a wolf recovery, and because we are, and I think we're demonstrating that. Nonetheless, there are those who think that we are not accurately representing the interests of the people in Washington by our draft letter and our previous comments that support delisting. And Conservation Northwest, I think their idea of establishing a new DPS, you know, that may be a different way to get there. But this whole issue about the two different subspecies, and when you look at the map of where those subspecies occur, is a question that's out there. But so I just wanted to spend a little bit of time on that piece. Lastly, on a lighter note,
which is a good thing.
It's a good thing. You recall that they were discovered and have infested Capitol Lake right over here, and when we had a really cold spell, I don't even know if it was 2 years ago, it could have been last year, I've lost track of time a little bit, came up with the idea that maybe draining the lake or reducing the level of the lake and exposing the mud snails to some freezing temperatures might reduce the numbers of them. So that's being done right now, and there's one right there. There's a bunch of them on right there that you can see. And here we got one of our folks out there collecting some. And there's one of the little critters right there. He looks kind of icy. Looks a little cold. He's cold. I don't know if he's dead or alive, but and there's some couple there that also look pretty cold. And then I think this is very similar. Oh, there's some on a glove. So we've been working with folks here in Olympia, and we've got the lake level reduced, and we've been coordinating with the Department of Enterprise Services is the one that manages the Capitol grounds here, including the lake. And so we've been using this latest cold snap to try to make some progress on reducing the number of those little critters in the lake. We've also, public affairs and our fish program are working with several Northwest states and British Columbia to develop an invasive species passport thing. And right next to that cup, underneath the piece of paper, you could just hand those around. The document is designed to educate and encourage boaters to stop the spread of invasive species on their boats and or from their boats and others' watercraft. And the legislature approved our participation in the Northwest Passport Program last session and provided us a little bit of funding to do that. And so here's a draft passport that we've been working up to try to use as an educational piece for boaters so that we can try to get them to do the right thing without having us to watch them in terms of spreading invasive species to other waterways in Washington. So that completes my director's report for this morning.
Terrific. Commissioner Smith.
Thanks, Bill. Very extensive. One quick question. Were those snails introduced by somebody dumping aquariums in there, do you know? Personal aquariums?
I don't. The best of my memory, and I haven't asked anybody that question for a couple years, but I don't think we know. I think we have some suspicions of where they might come from, but I don't remember that dumping anything out of an aquarium was one of them.
Okay. And not that there is a direct link between acidification, maybe there is, but has the department been involved in any of the conversations on the die-offs of the sea stars?
I don't know. I will find out for you. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. I strongly suspect so, but I can't say that with certainty.
Yeah, that seems to be a rather massive issue.
That's why I'm quite certain that we are.
I would appreciate it.
I don't want to say yes without being certain.
Thanks.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, I know in previous discussions about invasive species, I know I raised the question about what goes on at the port of entry when vessels are being hauled in from other states and perhaps even other countries on trucks, about what process might be in place to eradicate those at the port of entry so they don't just bypass and go into our waterways. Is there been any further follow-up on that? Or I know once we talked about spraying the vessels with some type of something that kills them or pressure washing, something like that.
Well, we do currently have these wash stations. We don't have very many of them, and one of the reasons that we want to get this piece of legislation back passed that provides some significant levels of funding is for us to increase our preventive work associated with regulations around moving watercraft from one water body to the other, having check stations, and at those check stations, increasing the number of check stations, and then having the equipment at those check stations that if those critters are detected, that they can be disposed of, washed at those wash stations. And if we had an opportunity for boaters to do that voluntarily, if they had wash stations where they could go to, I think is another piece. Those strategies are all, I think, incorporated in the design of our aquatic invasive species legislation and the funding that we're trying to generate from that legislation.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got a few comments. Let's see. The oversight committee that you talked about in relation to the co-managers work, the work plan with the co-managers, who's on the oversight committee?
The committee does not have a list of members. Anyone from the tribes can be on that oversight committee. And so generally, those oversight committees maybe had 20 or so people come to them, 8 to 10 tribes represented, and sometimes the tribes that were represented would change from meeting to meeting, but we had kind of a core group of people that made up the oversight committee.
And that's how you expect that it's going to continue, since it'd be very hard to pick a subgroup.
You don't go out and pick. So the tribes are free to have representation at the oversight committee at any. So, okay. But you obviously need to have a core groups that are dedicated to being a part of those oversight committees in order to make them effective and have some continuity, so which we did have up until about 2 years ago.
Okay. So. I just wanted to make some comments on the wolf recovery issue. I just wanted to say that we've completed another year without a lawsuit blocking management, as has happened in every other state. So real kudos for that. That's an achievement in and of itself. Just that we can stay out of court takes a tremendous amount of work. Commissioner Caney talked about, you know, the elements of the work that's being done. But another big part of it is just the sheer amount of outreach, the openness to both sides, the kind of keeping steady course in the middle, that's just really commendable. I think a lot of us who are involved in developing the wolf plan, you know, had a lot of fears about how the implementation would go. Because you can make great statements about what you intend to do, but when reality has to be faced, you hit the problems on the ground, it sometimes just, well, most states have found that they couldn't manage this problem. They ended up in court. We haven't. So that's really an astonishing achievement, I think. You know, I expected that we would be in court by now. So congratulations on that. And it also goes, just that sheer fact that we've been able to deal with all sides and keep on this path towards managed recovery is an illustration and a demonstration and proof to me that we have the competence to do this job. And I cannot imagine the federal government being able to do this job. And they're stuck in a recovery protections only model, and I can't imagine them being able to manage wolves. So that's an element of why I feel very, very strongly myself that we need to advance what our position. Fortunately, we have the people with us, but this position makes sense from the department's point of view on federal delisting because we do have the competence, and the federal government just lacks the personnel in the field, et cetera, the ability to work with stakeholders. So I'm absolutely firmly committed and supportive of what you've written in this letter, and I think other commissioners are too. Commissioner Schmitten suggested that we somehow include in this document the strong commission support for this letter and everything that it says in it. Is there any objection to that? Okay. So okay. Just wanted to go on the
Thank
record.
You.
I was one of the ones who felt like I needed a lot of therapy after the Wolf Plan because I just thought, the good statements we were making were one thing, but whether we could follow through and pull this off in a responsible and professional way was another thing. But you guys have done it so far. But there's a lot of hard work still ahead. We realize that. And some of the hardest things ahead have to do with what happened. How do we protect deer and elk populations? How do we even know when they're being affected by wolves? That's going to be a tough one. So, thank you for that. And just one, we're almost at the time to go to break, but do you have a sense of when the federal government's going to be making a decision on the budget, mm-hmm. on the fisheries-related, the production mass marking-related decisions?
Well, the president's budget is supposed to be out like in the first week of February. What's that? For fiscal year 15. the discussions that are going on relative to sequestration and whether there's a different suite of reductions that will be proposed from that committee for Congress to make rather than these across-the-board reductions is a key element as to whether or not the reductions that we're estimating right now are going to hold or not. Or I mean, they could get worse. It doesn't mean they'll get better, but yeah, they might. We're timing our trip to be after the, you know, after the president's budget comes out, but before a whole lot of debate gets teed up within the within Congress on 15, and of course we're also, I don't remember offhand the timing of the committee that's working on the sequestration, the alternatives to sequestration cuts, January 15th. Yeah, that's right. The continuing resolution runs out January 15th, so something's going to happen, give one way or another. It'll be, you know, another one of those government shutdown deals if they don't. So I can't say with certainty, but it's, you know, over the course of the next 2 or 3 months, it's going to be pretty critical.
Okay.
And then the deputy director has a bit to add to before the break, if you have the, if you can wait for a few minutes.
All right. Anything else for the director? Thank you. Deputy Director Storr.
The successes, and I appreciate your compliments and your remarks. There's a host of people. I mean, yeah. Donnie was, where'd Donnie go? He left. From Nate to Dave to Donnie to Stephanie, the field folks have just done an incredible job. The reorganization of our wildlife conflict specialist and putting additional people out on the ground, all those kinds of things have all contributed, I think, in a big way to the success that we've had. So I'm really proud to be a part of the group.
Just keep us out of court. Deputy Director Storr.
Morning, Madam Chair. Morning, Commissioners. I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to highlight some pretty exciting work that's going on. I think you're aware that our capital asset management program that's headed up by Assistant Director Tim Burns is in the middle of implementing the Jobs Now Act. And if you remember, in the last couple of budget sessions, we've received tens of millions of dollars as part of this Jobs Now Act. And that's so essential to us because it's letting us attack the infrastructure backlog of repair on our lands and roads and boat ramps and hatcheries that's been there for a long time. And even maybe more important, it's putting a lot of money on the ground in local communities across the state. So just an example of how the energy around that's geared up. If you look at the amount of dollars we put on the ground in fiscal year 12, which, you know, two Junes ago, versus fiscal year 13, which ended this last June, we tripled the amount of money on the ground that we're putting out there. And so far, fiscal year 14, we're ahead of pace from 13. So there's about a 6 month to a year lag in terms of actual construction because you have to go through engineering and design and permitting and all that kind of stuff. But we are putting money on the ground out there, and we have two projects that I wanted to highlight for you. One is the Voits Creek Hatchery, where this is up near Orting. We're constructing a new hatchery that includes a new intake, fish ladder, water supply piping, rearing ponds, adult ponds, pollution abatement ponds, an office building, a hatchery building, a storage building, relocating the existing residence, and demolition. This is going to amount to about $10.5 million. And we have awarded that contract now, and we are anticipating a late January construction start and completion by June of 2015. So a fairly major project. This hatchery was essentially wiped out by flooding back in 07 and 08. And, so now we've relocated, purchased some new land, and this facility is being built, which is a big part of the local community there, too. Another fairly major project is the upland work on the Point No Point boat launch. We are demolishing existing buildings, putting in new parking for vehicles and trailers, a vault toilet, fencing, entry gate, stormwater control. This is for just under $1 million. We opened bids around the 20th of November and anticipate a contract award this month. Construction would start in 2014. And we're negotiating mitigation requirements for the in-water work, too. So there's the upland work, getting the old facility out of there and the place cleaned up, new parking, and then there'll be work in the water, too, to reconstruct the boat ramp. So very important access point for us there, and real excited about that. So I just wanted to just highlight that for you. I think Assistant Director Burns is going to come and talk to you in January or February about the overall program, but we're real excited about it.
Great. That is terrific news. I only wish former Commissioner Perry was here to hear it. Okay. Any questions for the deputy? No? All right. We're ready for a break.